Rico Petrucelli.
All right.
Welcome to the PMP Network.
Well, it's good to be with you. I really, really am excited about what's been going on.
You know, it's hard to believe.
In my middle age.
For guys like me, it's hard to believe that the impossible dream was 40 years ago.
Yeah, well, I know it. Me too.
I mean, well, you were 24 years old then, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the thing is, though, you know, you look back and sometimes you take it, at least I do, by decades and say, okay, the next decade after that, this happened, the next decade, next thing, you know, I know, whoa, where'd those 4 decades go?
It's just amazing to me. My family had been season ticket holders since 1964. So we actually sat in the front row on the first base side for many, many years till they built the 2 rows in front of us a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And we got to know most of the players because they would all come over. We have a picture on our wall of George Scott and my little sister, who at the time was 10 or 9, you know, posing with him. And,
yeah.
But that was those days. I'll never forget the Red Sox. They were terrible.
Oh, yeah.
And they finished ninth in 1966, and not much was expected of them. And I remember that summer when they hired Dick Williams, him telling everybody they were going to win, you know, more games than they lost, and people laughed.
Yeah, that's right. Now, we were all surprised. I mean, we started believing in ourselves about the middle of the year after we won 10 in a row, but of 67, but 60, I was, my first year was 65. We lost 100 games, and then 66, as you mentioned, 99, and then the Red Sox made changes. Dick O'Connell came on the scene, and of course he hired Dick Williams, which was a great move, and Dick brought a whole new attitude to the club and to the organization.
We got some kind of buzzing in the line right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And not good. Maybe coming from your side.
Oh.
So I'm going to call you right back again, try it again.
All right.
Okay. Here you go, Petrucelli. We have a better line now. Isn't that weird that the cellular one's clearer than the landline?
That's a shock to me.
it's just the way it is nowadays with the high technology we have.
But, I know.
So we're talking about low technology. Let's go back again to 1967. By the way, Rico has written a great book. It's called Rico Petrucelli's Tales from the Impossible Dream Red Sox, by Rico Petrucelli with Chaz Scoggins, and it's from sportspublishingllc.com. It's available in all the bookstores. It's online, and you can get it at sportspublishingllc.com as well. First of all, I guess before we even start here, before we go back in time, why did you end up writing a book?
Well, I'll tell you, I was approached a few years ago by Sports Publishing, and even before that, individuals, and I said, nah, you know, there's a lot of books out. I said, geez, another book on the Red Sox. And then Chaz Scoggins, who I've known a long, long time, Sports Publishing, he's written a couple of other books for them on players. And he came, he gave me a call and said, geez, you know, 40 years now, this is a great one. You know, we'd love to have you do it. And I said, well, you know, it's probably my last chance to talk a little bit about that 67 team and the Red Sox planning a number of celebrations this year. So I said, all right, Jazz, let's go do it. And so I think, I don't know, if it was a different writer, I don't know if I would do it. I know Chaz for a long time. He's a great guy, and he's an excellent writer, and I just felt really comfortable with him.
You've still been a presence in Boston. I mean, you still come to the Fenway, and people still recognize you, and you've been involved in broadcasting and other things as well. So your name is still out there, which is, again, 40 years later. It must be kind of surprising to you.
Well, yeah, but we still get, I know Jim Longborg lives in Scituate, and a couple of the other guys live in the area, and it's the same thing with them. People still come up to them and talk about or want to know, you know, what it was like in 67 with that ball club. And it's always fun, of course. And even younger kids who kind of read a little bit about Red Sox history will come and ask some questions. So, it was just such a great year and such an important year. I mean, it was really important. Little did we know at the time how important it was to win, to have an improved team, to get the fans some excitement, because as you mentioned earlier, we were talking about how few people were in the stands in 65, 66, 64, those early 60s. So This brought a lot of fans back.
Yeah, we were there and paying for games and getting season tickets, and the Red Sox rewarded us by moving us from first row to third row and by jacking up the prices. But, hey, it's the way it is, I guess. You know, there's not much I can do about it. I will remember one thing about the 67 season. It was I remember the end of the year, and Kai Yastrzemski had almost a superhuman effort. He hit over 500 for like the last 10 games, and he was amazing.
Oh, he was amazing. He was so hungry. I mean, he wanted it. He wanted to win. I came up 65. He came up in 61 with the bad team, so he had a number of other tough years as far as winning was concerned. So when Williams came on the scene and he says, guys, you know, we want to win here. We're going to win more than we lose. Yaz and everybody was up for that, and we did what we had to do. But, boy, that you're right, that last couple of weeks especially, but actually all year, Carl was just on another level. He was so unbelievable, knocking in runs, throwing guys out, taking the extra base. He did it all.
A lot of people forget, too, that when Carl came in, the pressure must have been enormous. He was, quote-unquote, the replacement for Ted Williams.
Yeah, right, which is impossible. But, you know, our fans are, you know, we'd like to see another star. Yaz had gotten a big bonus at that time, and he was getting a lot of publicity, you know, not so much that the press was, or the Red Sox were saying he was going to be the next Williams, but the fans were looking for somebody great, you know.
Exactly.
And, he pressed in those early years.
And there were detractors as well, and again, because you can't be Ted Williams, and you know, did you ever get to know Ted?
I was very fortunate. He was just great. I mean, you know, I would I wrote him a few times in the off season when I was in the minors. You know, ask him advice on hitting, and he would come to spring training and love to work with the young players and teach hitting. And he got so excited every time you talked to him. You can hear him, you know, for miles. Get pumped up about what to do up at that plate. And he was bigger than life. What a swing. I'll never forget it. In spring training, when he was working with the young kids, he was showing one of the kids about hitting, you know, and the guy was a left-hander, too. I was out in the outfield with mostly young players who stayed back because the big team went to play an exhibition game. And he got a little frustrated with the pitcher, because he wasn't getting the ball over. The guy was probably scared stiff. The Williams would yell at him. But he got in the batter's box, and he hit four balls out of the ballpark in right field over my head, and all of us, our mouths were open. What a swing. Oh, my God. Just absolutely beautiful. Picture swing. You know, that big, long, lean. Even in those days, he had, you know, still hadn't gained weight. He looked great. And with that follow-through was just, it was like a picture postcard.
Now, there were many characters on that team. One of the great quotes in this book, and I'm trying to find it, but it was a Ted Williams quote about George Scott, that he was like talking to cement or something like that.
Okay. Oh, Dick Williams, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dick Williams. Well, Dick Williams got on George a lot because he felt he had to. He felt he had to get on George to get the best out of him. If he didn't, then he was worried that George would get a little bit too laid back. And George had a little bit of a weight problem, so Dick weighed him almost, started out in spring training every day, and then during the season maybe once a week. And if he was overweight, it could be a pound, he was sitting on the bench. I mean, Williams kept his word, you know, and he just he did that with Foy, a few other guys as well. So so Scott, you know, at that one time, yeah, he called him a cement head because he wouldn't change bats. You know, he suggested to Scott that he go to a lighter bat, and Scott says, go on my 46-ouncer. Mm-hmm. Oh, he swung a log. I mean, that thing was enormous. And he, you know, he wasn't hitting. He was hitting 190. He said, come on, George, you know, do something here. I mean, let's face it. So he says, well, you know, Williams was quoted, he's a big cement head, and he doesn't want to listen. And then, of course, it was headlines in the paper.
Yeah. One of the things that always struck me, as I said, I was a Red Sox fan before we got season tickets. I remember Eddie Brousseau at shortstop. You took his spot. What kind of relationship did you have with him?
Well, not great. I mean, Eddie was a real pro. I didn't really take his spot. They gave me a spot. He had a good year in 64, and when I came to spring training, and the Red Sox had made their mind up to bring the young guys up. Tony C was, and Dalton Jones came up in 64. Myself, Jim Lomborg, well, I think one or two other young players came up, and then finally when Williams came, he brought a bunch of others. And Eddie, that year when I came up, I was trying to ask Eddie a few things and about shortstop, you know, the hitters and all that, and he just kind of, just kind of walk away. And I was taking over his job, so he was a competitive guy. I understood it. So I went to some of the other players, like Frank Malzone and Yaz and them, and they helped me out. But that's just the way it was. I mean, and I didn't think too much about it, but I did realize that, he was he wanted to play, and so did I.
1967 also brings back a terrible memory for all of us who were watching that day when Tony Cuniglero got hit by a Jack Hamilton pitch.
Yeah.
That must have been something for the folks like yourself who were there and saw the whole thing and maybe didn't realize the severity of the whole thing as well.
Well, I was on deck, and when it hit him, you could see it was the ball coming in. It was up around his head. And Tony, who never gave ground, didn't move at all until the ball was right on him. Then I guess the umpire and the catcher says, she yelled out to watch out, and he just moved his head enough to where he would have gotten a hit in the temple if he didn't, and that could have been even more severe. But he got hit under the eye, and of course that led to a hole in his eye, a detached retina. I mean, all kinds of stuff. It was so sad. But eventually he did make a comeback, which was amazing.
It was. In fact, I think he got 40 home runs one of those years when he came back.
Yeah, we got, after Tony was out, we were fortunate to get Ken Harrelson.
Yeah, the Hawk.
Ken Harrelson was there, because he could hit. Kenny could hit, that's one thing. And did a nice job the rest of the way for us. He wasn't noted for his fielding. I think he made famous the one-hand catch. And we used to ask him, why catch in one hand? He said, he says, well, it's not that I am worried about missing the ball. He says, I want to protect my nose in case they misjudge it. It'll hit me right in the nose. And he had a pretty good honker there.
Mm. Yeah, I'm still thinking about Tony C at this point, because I remember his brother Billy also joining the team. And you have to remember that Tony C did die at 45 years old.
Oh yeah, that was so sad.
A terrible thing. But Hawk did a great job in the field replacing him, and also was quite a character off the field as well.
Oh, he was. The Hawk was great, real flashy dancer. He liked to go out, and celebrate, and was a character. Was a wonderful guy. Everyone liked him, he made the Nehru suits famous. Because they were in fashion for a very, very short length of time. But right in between, Ken ordered 25 or 30 Nehru suits, all different colors, and they came into the clubhouse, and he was trying them on, and said, oh, yeah, it looks good. And a week later, really, no more than a week later, they were completely out of style. Just all of a sudden, the fashion world turned, said, that's it. I don't know what they thought of it. It was terrible. And Hawk says, I can't believe this. You got 25 suits here. What am I going to do with this? I don't know what he did with them, but we used to laugh at that. And then he'd buy shoes, different color shoes. He'd have them dyed, chartreuse or red. Just a character. And he loved Boston, and the fans loved him.
Whatever happened to Ken?
Well, he got traded, eventually got traded to Cleveland. And played a few more years, then went into the broadcast field here at in Boston for a number of years, and now he's in Chicago. He's been there a long time now as a broadcaster for them. So he's done very well.
Have you guys had any kind of formal reunions?
Well, 67 team had a 30-year reunion. That was a pretty good one. We had a big dinner, and they did something on the field for us. And this year, it's going to be something. Opening day, and then throughout the year, they're going to have a few things to celebrate this team.
I noticed they do have folks doing autograph sessions in there. We've walked in a couple of times. I remember one of my favorite players was there doing autographs, Jerry Moses. A lot of people don't even know who he is, but he was one of my favorite players. But yeah. Have you been doing those autograph sessions as well?
Well, I did one. Out there by the street, I forget what they call that, but the guys go there for an hour and sign autographs as the people are coming in. But I've been up in that the Legend Suite they have that they rent out every game, and they have a former player go in there and meet everyone and say a few words.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun for us folks, you know, who've experienced it all, and for the young kids who are meeting a ball player that their parents may be talking about, but they may not know.
Yeah.
Jim Lomborg had an amazing year in 1967, and then had a ski accident or some situation happen. I remember that kind of derailed his career. He's a dentist now. But one of the things that I remember, aside from the fact that he had a great year, was the World Series, where he was just so tired, and Bob Gibson was just unbelievable.
Yeah, Gibson was absolutely right. Great, won the three games, but Jim Lomborg decided to pitch him with 2 days rest, figuring that, you know, maybe a Lomborg, especially that year with 2 days, is probably 2 days rest is probably better than somebody with 5 days rest, you know, at this point. So they did. They went ahead and they started him, and you could see he just didn't have his good stuff. His curveball, fastball straightened out a little bit, and they hit. They got a few runs early off him, and of course Gibson was on. I mean, he was always on. And he pitched a great game. So, yeah, you know, even with that, though, because of the team doing so well, I mean, it was like we won it. I mean, just the fans just couldn't wait till next year. We couldn't either. We thought, of course, we were going to win it every year.
Mm.
But as you mentioned also, that Lomborg got hurt and Joe Foy got hurt, a couple of other guys. You know, they just didn't have that kind of year. They wouldn't pitch to Yaz. I mean, they were throwing everything in the dirt, walking him, and so it was different. It was tougher, but that 67 team really brought the fans back and kind of saved the franchise, and that's the big thing we're proud of. We're very fortunate to have been part of that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we all went through 67 together. We all went through 78 and all the different years that the Red Sox came close. And I'll tell you, I never thought I was going to see 2004, but What an amazing thing. How'd you feel as a player seeing them go all the way?
Well, I felt great. I really did, especially living here. And, you know, there were a number of players, because I worked for the Red Sox organization up until 97, and had guys like Nixon and Veritek, Derek Lowe, three or four other guys that were on that team were in Pawtucket. Ken Maka was the manager. I was the hitting coach. And we saw those guys go through. It was just great to see them. But they handled it so classy. I mean, they thanked us, you know, and they said, I remember the celebration in the clubhouse, guys, and Theo Epstein was saying, you know, thank you to the former players. This is for you guys, too. Mm. You know, it's just not for us, for the fans who waited all those years. And, boy, I thought that was real classy.
It was. I just can imagine how you guys felt who went, you know, to the seventh game of a World Series in an earlier year. Yeah, talking about Trot Nixon, he hit three hits for his new team.
Yeah, Trot's, if he's healthy, he's gonna do well. That's the key for him to stay healthy all year. I don't think the Sox, if he hadn't gotten, you know, injured all that time, they probably would have kept him. But you can understand those things happening. That's part of the game. He understands it. I was fortunate never to get traded, you know. And so when I was talking to the other guys, is the first time's the toughest because you look back, you're rejected by your old team. You think they don't like you anymore. They don't like you the way they used to, of course, because they feel they have to trade you and get somebody else in. But you can't take it personal. And then they say, well, after that, then it's if you get traded again, it's, you know, well, it's just here we go again. It's nothing. So, but I was fortunate.
You were lucky. And talking about people who were here for a short time, Edgar Renteria comes up with two home runs yesterday and wins a game.
Yeah, I saw that too. It's a surprise. If you stood next to him, he is big. He's a big guy. He's wide. He's agile for his size. But you know, you say, wow. You think maybe this kid might hit 30 home runs some year, and all of a sudden he'll do what he did yesterday, hit two, and then he won't hit one for a month. because he's basically a line drive hitter. He'll end up with 10, 15 at the most.
Mm. You know, it's interesting that you talk about his size, because the size of players in general is much bigger now than it was 40 years ago when you were playing. I mean, you know, these guys, you know, whether it was through artificial means at some point getting bigger, but there are a lot of big guys in the league now.
Well, you're right. Look at Big Papi. God, he's like 260 pounds, 6'4", 6'5". And then you get guys, these other guys on all these teams, 230, 6'5", 6'4", some of the pitchers, 6'8". You know, Sexton for Seattle, he's 6'7". I mean,
yeah.
You know, you just don't see that many guys. But you're right. No, there are a lot bigger players nowadays.
There's only a few Dustin Pedroias in the league.
Yeah, right. And Eckstein. How about Eckstein over there?
Exactly, I always like Eckstein. I wish the Red Sox would pick him up.
Yeah, I wish they would have kept him. You're not kidding.
Yeah, I like him.
Yeah, he's a tough battler. You know, he's a competitor. He never gives up.
I had the thrill of meeting some of the 67 participants when they ran a camp, and I got to know Dick Raddatz and Gary Bell pretty well.
Oh yeah.
Tell us a little bit about those guys. Dick was really a great guy, big guy, but one of the nicest guys.
And a great pitcher. He really had some great years here at the Sox. You know, one year I think he pitched 160 innings. This is for a reliever, closer.
Mm-hmm.
And one year, I think he struck out 180 guys. It was just incredible. You know, but he was used a lot. He's maybe overused, but you know, it's tough. It's tough when you got a game on the line. You got a guy out there who you know can do the job. That is a closer, and sometimes he has to go more innings. Most managers will do that. But Raddatz was just a great guy, too. He was funny, kept everybody loose. Bell, the same way. And those two guys used to go down to fantasy camp and be the commissioners. They would find players down there. This was the campers, you know, people
right.
who wanted to play.
Yeah.
And we just had a great time every time we went down there. But Bell was the same way. Bell could throw in the middle 90s. I'm telling you, he could throw. When he was with Cleveland, we faced him, and we used to have to take extra bats to go to Cleveland because guys like him and Sonny Siebert and Louis Tion at the time was there, and Steve Hargan could all throw up in the 90s. And, boy, they were tough. They'd come inside. You said, whoop, another broken bat. There we go. Good thing I brought extras. Those two guys. I miss Raddatz. I really miss Dick Raddatz. Mm. He was just terrific.
He was a great guy.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about 67 was the emergence of a rookie pitcher who came close to getting into the Hall of Fame for one pitching effort. And he pitched twice against the Yankees and was unbelievable. After that, kind of nothing.
Yeah, Billy Rohr. Billy had that great game against the Yankees, and everything was going right for him. He, of course, certainly was excited about pitching in Yankee Stadium. He had a great curveball that day. He was hitting spots. I mean, keeping the ball down, everything you wanted for a pitcher to do. And I think it was only two tough outs. I think Tony C made a running catch, and then Yaz made the great catch.
The one that was on the album. One of the greatest catches we've ever seen in left field.
Oh, that yeah. really was. Oh, they show that. When they show that on TV, you know, you could see that it was absolutely unbelievable.
Mm.
And then, you know, after that catch, we said, oh, yeah, he's got to do it. He's got to do the no-hitter now. And then here comes Elston Howard, who was no longer really able to swing the bat real well, and then he just got one off the inside, almost hit his fingers, and he just muscled it out over the second baseman's head for the first hit.
Those guys Tony C desperately wanted to get that ball. There was no chance, of course, to get it.
But it was a great effort.
It was.
And then,
yeah.
Right, by Rohr, and then he pitched one more good game, and after that, he got shelled.
Yeah, and Elston Howard was the one who broke up his shutout in the second game as well, and Howard ended up with the Red Sox that year.
That's right, yeah. Got him at the middle of the year.
Yeah, I mean, it was so exciting. I remember watching that Billy Rohr game. It was something you'd never forget.
Oh, definitely not. You know, and he went on the Ed Sullivan Show. As you recall, Ed Sullivan would bring on people like that, you know, and have them sit in the audience and then introduce them, and then he did that, and Rohr got up there because we teased him in the clubhouse, next day that, you know, him, about him being introduced on the Ed Sullivan Show. My God, you that good? So I had some fun with him, but yeah. I mean, after that, it was just, it was weird. Just the guy just didn't have anything after that.
Do you know what happened to him?
Well, he lives in California. He usually comes to the to these type of reunions. He'd probably be here, but he's an attorney. He's done very well.
Oh, okay.
Attorney in Los Angeles.
Yeah. And there was a lot of interesting characters on that team. And Dalton Jones, who came up when you came up, was a great utility infielder. Boy, every time they needed him, he came in there and did the job.
Yeah, he was a great pitcher. He could come off the base, off the bench. He was one of those guys, and that's tough to do. But he could do it. He had a sweet swing, too, and he could hit the ball out of the ballpark. It hit to all fields, and he and I roomed together. He was my only roommate, basically, in 5 years or so. And he used to say to me, you know, Roomy, I want to play every day. I want to play every day. I'd say, Roomy, but you're a great, you know, you're great coming off the bench. We need guys like you. Yeah, but I want to, you know. So he finally did get traded in to Detroit and did not have a good year playing every day.
Yeah. Some people just have that talent of coming off and doing it. And there was another guy, that, Jerry Adair, that did the same kind of thing.
Well, Adair was, yeah, even more so. Adair played a great field, played shortstop, third base. He filled in second base, which is his normal position. He got all big hits for us time and time again. And then he got that big home run against the Angels where we were 8 runs behind and tied it up 8-8. And then Jerry hit the home run to make it 9-8 to win it. So, yeah, he was terrific that year.
Do you ever listen to that 67 album, The Impossible Dream? What a great album that is.
Oh, yeah, sure. I think it's a collector's item now. It's, it was Jess Kane, I think,
yep.
Sang...
Kai Yastrzemski song.
Kai Yastrzemski.
The Man They Call Yes.
Yeah. And, boy, it was a very memorable, terrific year. Bringing back the interest in the Red Sox, don't forget Dick O'Connell, he won the executive of the year. Dick Williams won the manager of the year, and Lomborg, Cy Young, and Yaz the MVP, plus the triple crown.
Exactly,
that guided to do that.
Yeah, it was an amazing year, and it's all chronicled in Rico Petrocelli's Tales from the Impossible Dream Red Sox. Rico Petrocelli with Chaz Scoggins. It's from Sports Publishing, LLC. You can go to sportspublishingllc.com, or you can go to Amazon or any site and order the book. It's a great book. You will enjoy it. It is out now. Hey, Rico, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's great. It is great to reminisce. And I always tell, when I'm on, or I see youngsters, I say, hey, you know, you're going to do that someday. Don't laugh at us old-timers, because you're going to remember your era. Maybe the guys of today, the 2004 team, and look back and talk about them just like we're talking about the teams in the 60s and 70s. So it's just great. Nothing like Red Sox baseball.
Yeah, the 67 team, though, has a special part of people's hearts. They're the cardiac kids. They were come from behind.
Yeah.
They were underdogs the whole way. And that's something that really... That's something movies are made of. Kind of like the Miracles on Ice with the hockey team. I mean, there are just so many things. It's not even the fact that the Red Sox won the championship in 2004, but it was the 67. They came from almost last place, ninth place, and came up there. So it was a completely different kind of scenario.
Well, that's true. That's a great point. 100 to 1 odds for us to win it, and that's like it might as well have been a million to one. You know, because if you go by the previous year, boy, this team was terrible. But a lot of new faces, as I mentioned, and a good manager, and just very, very exciting.
Things gelled, and it became the impossible dream. And thank you so much for reminiscing with us and for writing the book, Rico Petrocelli's Tales from the Impossible Dream Red Sox. Take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.